How's that? We're looking at a new section now, section number 6, which means we have reached the halfway point, which I know you're sad about, or maybe happy. I'll assume that you're sad. But you're happy that you've got so much already. 6 is apologetics and epistemology. Monson, in his book on Van Til, has two chapters. One's entitled, in the middle of the book, one's entitled The Apologetic Side of Epistemology. And the next chapter, and this is for the students, what's his next chapter? You should have read it by now. What's the next chapter named? To remind you, it's the first one is the Apologetic Side of Epistemology, and the other one is? The Apologetic Side of Epistemology. I think I got him backwards there. But he goes from one direction to another. He says that these two things are related, and he talks about them from different perspectives. And so what is the relationship between apologetics and epistemology? We are familiar with both those terms, hopefully, by now. What is the relationship? Well, we've talked about that quite a bit, but now in some more detail and in a more systematic way. Now, before we do this, the first question we're going to ask is let's precise up our knowledge of epistemology. Epistemology is a study of knowledge, right? The theory of knowledge. Now, what do we want to know about that before we begin to discuss it in depth? We want to know what knowledge is. What is knowledge? Now, knowledge is something that has been discussed by philosophers since way back in Plato's day, and Plato's definition is still, to a certain degree, serviceable today. So we're going to look at Plato's old definition, and we're going to criticize it. We're going to also show where it's deficient, but it is at least something that is helpful to begin with. So when you ask the question, we all make claims to know things. I know that the Braves are a worse team than the Dodgers. That's not funny at all. It's the truth. This is an expansion team, in my opinion. The Dodgers are a real baseball team. There's only about 6 to 7 real baseball teams. Anything that came after the 60s is not a real baseball team. Oh, it's quiet in here. Oh, there's Atlanta fans. Okay. So I know certain things. I know that my wife's name is Julie. I know that California is located on the west coast of the United States of America. I know certain things. What constitutes knowledge? What constitutes my claims to knowledge? Just because I claim to know something, it's subject to challenge. And what are the ways in which somebody can challenge my claims to knowledge? And that is a way of getting us to the answer of what knowledge is. So what is knowledge? Well, some of you know that Plato had three aspects, or talked about three conditions for knowledge. The first condition is pretty obvious, although it's been attacked by some, and that is, first, in order to know something, you have to do what with it? You have to know, you have to believe it. In order to know something, you have to believe. And I'll use the verbal form, believe. Well, I'll use the nominal form, belief. You can't know something unless you believe it. Right? This is something that seems to be truism, although some philosophers have attacked it. Some of you know that I have a liking for the writings of Wittgenstein, and Wittgenstein actually attacked this. For those that are interested, he thinks that knowledge and belief are two different states altogether, and that knowledge is the cessation of belief. But, be that as it may, most agree that in order to know something, you have to believe it. It makes no sense to say that I know that the state of Washington is north of Oregon, but I don't believe it. Unless you're saying it in what way? An ironic way, right? Or a humorous way. Or stated incredulity. Yeah, I realize the truth, but I really can't believe it. You can't say that literally and make sense. Knowledge implies belief. So in order to know something, you have to believe it. Now, obviously, belief is not enough to get you to knowledge, is it? I believe many things, and many of those things that I believe, I cannot call knowledge because I'm missing certain things. Now, one of the things that mere belief misses or needs to be added to it in order to have knowledge is what? You tell me. Knowledge needs belief. That is, what is the object? What must the status of the object of your belief be? Correspond with reality, which is a way of saying, which is the correspondence is a theory of what? Correspondence theory of truth, right? Has to be true. Has to be true. So in order to have knowledge, you have to have belief that is true. Okay, so these two ingredients at least are necessary. Right? If you don't believe something, you can't know it. And if what you believe is false, you can't know it either. And both of these are necessary. Now, you could spend more time talking about what the nature of beliefs are and the nature of truths are. Okay, what is the nature of belief? Well, there's been some philosophers that have said it is a disposition to behave in a certain way. So you say John believes that the next card that turns up will be an ace. It's hard to bring a gambling example, but we're saying that some people think that what you say in there is that you believe that he is going to what? Raise the ante, right? He's going to raise the ante. He has a disposition to behave a certain way. That's all what is meant by X believes Y. X believes something, and so he has a disposition to behave in a certain way. It's a way of predicting. That's, of course, behaviorism. And there's something true about that, right? The way in which what we believe is a good indicator of how we're going to behave. It's also what can be called a mental attitude that's positive towards something, right? And that something is typically considered to be a proposition. A proposition. So, California is the golden state. That's a proposition, right? And the propositions have a truth value. They're either true or false, right? And so, our beliefs have as their objects, according to this view, a proposition. Now, of course, if you're a materialist, you're not going to believe this, are you? Because what are propositions? Propositions are things that are not material. Propositions are abstract entities. So materialists will speak in terms of sentences or statements. They'll never talk in terms of propositions. But that's their problem, not ours. We like propositions. Propositions are things that you don't feel, taste, or touch, but they are the carriers of truth and the carriers of meaning. So, proposition, California's golden state is true or false. If you believe it, your object of belief is that proposition. Now, let's say you have the object of your belief is California's golden state, and it's true, you have knowledge. Not necessarily. I'll get to the answer of why that is the case in a moment. Now, true, what is truth? What is truth? Well, Pilate asked that, right? What is truth? Now, there have been many attempts by philosophers to give an account of what truth is. And we heard one already, the correspondence theory of truth. And that's not so much a definition of truth, it's what? It's a criteria which we judge something, by which we judge something to be true. The correspondence theory of truth states that truth is that which corresponds, a true proposition is that which corresponds to a state of affairs in the world. Okay, now, is an example of a philosophical theory that is metaphorical and needs cashing out. Okay, how do you cash out corresponds? What does it mean for a proposition to correspond to a state of affairs in the world? What does it mean for a particular to participate in a universal? Right? There's no explanation given. It's not cashed out. But we have a sense of something about this being correct. A proposition is true if it is corresponds in some way to the world. So, if we say that Chalcedon is incoming, Georgia, then we can judge that to be true because we know that we are incoming, Georgia, and Chalcedon Presbyterian Church is located here. So there's something to the correspondence theory of truth, but it doesn't define truth. It gives us a criterion for truth. Then there is another candidate called the coherence view of truth, or the coherence theory of truth. The coherence theory of truth tells us that what is true is what coheres with other truths. Truth is, in other words, systemic. Truths do not exist in isolation from other truths. And so what is true is that which by other true propositions. Now, there's something about this that is right as well. It gives us some insight into the nature of also how we justify truths, but it's not a definition either. There's a pragmatic theory of truth. The pragmatic theory of truth says what? Truth is, this is a kind of a banal statement of it, but truth is what works, right? Truth is what allows you to do certain work. Truth is instrumental. That which is useful in achieving certain tasks, and pragmatists are almost always industrialist type of philosophers, right? They're always, well, American philosophers tend to be pragmatists, right? It's not just because we want things to work, but it has to have a cash value. You have to be able to cash it out. Knowledge, or excuse me, truth is what is usable towards a certain end. Is there anything correct about this? Yeah, there's some truth to this, but it's certainly not capturing the nature of truth. According to the Christian worldview, what is truth? God's word is true, but what is truth? Well, we'd say ultimately, God is true, right? What did Jesus say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. God is the truth, and God is identical to his word. That is the truth, right? That is what truth is, and these other theories of truth are able to tap into something, right? They answer certain questions that may be helpful for us to ask, but they don't really define what truth is. Truth is God himself. God is truth. And if you're in God, then you are in the truth. If you walk in his way, then you walk in the truth. If you don't walk in his way, then you don't walk in the truth. So as Christians, we're going to have our own way of conceiving things because our worldview is different. We believe that God is truth, and that's what essentially is. Same thing with good. What is good? Do we believe that goodness is something that God is because he happens to have a property? No, God is good because that's his nature. There's nothing that we test God against to make sure he's good. God is the standard of goodness. God is love. Does that mean God has a property of love that we judge to be part of him because of some external standard? No, God is love. It's his nature. There's nothing outside of God that determines or allows us to check him against in order to see if he has certain properties. Same thing with truth. God is true not because we compare him to a form or some paradigm of truth, but because God himself is the truth. And so we're not going to take our definitions from the pagan world or the secular world. So our conception, though we may agree with Plato so far, that knowledge is at least true belief, we're not going to agree with Plato or the other non-Christian philosophers as to what true constitutes or what truth constitutes. We have our own understanding based upon our own worldview. So just because we agree with Plato formally so far doesn't mean we agree with him in the matter. Okay, so knowledge at least so far is true belief. Is that enough, though? If I believe something that's true, do you necessarily conclude that I have knowledge? Let's say somebody asked me what population of grasshoppers in coming. What county are we in? Forsyth, how many grasshoppers are in Forsyth? And for some reason, I am dogmatic about it. 12 billion grasshoppers. Now, let's say it turns out that there are 12 billion grasshoppers in Forsyth County. Would I have known that there was that many grasshoppers in the county? Now, chances are you'd say that's a lucky guess. Now, let's make an example from real life. What happens when somebody wins the lotto? They often say, at least I've heard this before, I knew this number was it, right? I knew this was it. My grandma's Social Security number written backwards, divided by 12 to the square root of 3, I knew that was going to be it. Did they know it? Now, did they have a true belief? Do they believe that the number is it? Sure. Did they have a true belief? Turns out they did. Did they know it? Of course they didn't know it, right? Of course they didn't know it. Somebody, as they say, goes, has to win. By the way, that's the state loves people to to get people to play the lottery, right? Somebody has to win. You know, the chances are it's not going to be you, but somebody has to win. So that person forms a belief that this is, I knew this because I did in fact win. Whereas the 999,000 other people that knew it also turned out to be false. So they didn't know it. So belief that is true is not enough to give you knowledge. What else is necessary? What is that person missing? Must be justified. Must be justified. So now we know what knowledge is. Let's move on to the next point. Knowledge is true, justified belief. Not so fast, right? Knowledge is at least true belief plus something else. Now, we call it justification. Plato called it logos, right? Which means it can be translated in this case justification, but it means a rationale, a reason. There has to be a reason behind it. Can't be a lucky guess. So what is justification? And that's going to be the big question now, right? I mean, these are big questions here. What is belief? What is truth? And we're going to differ with the non-Christian philosophers on these answers to these things. But for our purposes, this is going to be the big question here. What is justification? What constitutes justification for a belief? And there are many answers to this question. How you answer this question is going to depend upon what? What is this section titled? Apologetics and epistemology. So how you view justification is going to be determined by your epistemological theory, right? Your epistemological theory is going to determine what your justification is. So what would the empiricists accept as justification for of their true beliefs? What would they count as justification? Some type of empirical experience, of course, right? What would a rationalist consider to be a justification for their beliefs? Some type of belief that's produced by some logical analysis, right? Now, rationalism doesn't deny that we can't, does not deny we can know things through empirical means. They say that it's not just empirical means that we know things, it's not the most important things. But yeah, they'll say it has to be through the deliverances of reason, our use of logic to get us to a certain thing. Okay, so you can see here that though we can perhaps all agree that knowledge is at least true justified belief, we don't really agree when it comes down ultimately to what that means. Okay, the devil's in the details. The details are what's important. So what constitutes justification? So we have different epistemologies are going to have different answers to that. Now we're going to come back to this in a moment, but I want to point out something else to you. Is it true that knowledge is true justified belief? Let's just say we have this filled in sufficiently. Right? We understand that it's appropriate. Is knowledge true justified belief? Plato thought so. Most philosophers who have considered this thought so. Is it really the case? Well, let me give you a scenario, and then you tell me if the person in the scenario has knowledge. He's going to have all of these things that are listed here on the board. Let's say that somebody is watching. I'll use an old example because I don't know anything much about modern sports. But just say somebody's watching on CBS the finals of Wimbledon. And the finalists are, this will date me, Yvonne Lindell and John McEnroe. Now, you're watching it, and near the end, you go to the kitchen to get something to drink and eat. In the meantime, CBS has lost its satellite connection to Wimbledon. They've put on briefly that they have done so, and that in the meantime, while they restore the feed, they're going to play last year's finals at Wimbledon. And last year's finalists were Yvonne Lindell and John McEnroe. So all this has transpired, and you come in and sit down, and you watch what you think is the end of this finals match of Wimbledon for 2007, though this would be the geriatric Wimbledon, right? I'm sure McEnroe is well beyond his playing days. So now you come, you watch it, and it turns out that we've got to be Americans about this, right? McEnroe beats him. McEnroe beats Lindell. So what do you do? Without trying, you're going to form the belief that McEnroe is the 2007 Wimbledon champion. Now, unbeknownst to you, but what's going on in Wimbledon is that McEnroe beats Ivan Lendl. He defends his title and he beats Lendl again. So you form the belief that McEnroe is the 2007 Wimbledon champion. You form a belief that happens to be true. Right? We just set it up that it's true. Now, let me ask you this question. Are you justified in believing that? Somebody says no. Let me ask you it this way. If we were the thought police, right? Let's say that Debbie Minkoff, to pick on her again, Debbie Minkoff formed this belief, right? And I was the thought police and you were the thought jury. And I accused her of the crime of having an unjustified belief. And Pastor Johnson is her defense attorney. Are you going to defend your client, and do you think you have grounds to defend her? Is she unjustified in forming that belief? Is she flouting some epistemological duty? Has she failed some way? As the thought police, you failed. You're not justified. And you say what? Well, you'd say that's not fair, right? She's justified in believing that. She's justified in believing that because she saw it. Okay, we can think of other instances. You asked me when's the last time it rained in Virginia? Since rain is on the mind of everybody these days. When's the last time it rained in Virginia? And I look at you, and I have no idea, but I just make something up. Yeah, it rained yesterday. Just quit bothering me, kid, right? Run along. Yesterday, yeah, okay. Now, it turns out that it did rain yesterday in Virginia. But I don't believe that, right? I'm just making it up. Now, you formed the belief that it rained yesterday in Virginia. You have a true belief that it rained yesterday in Virginia. And you consider me to be reliable, basically honest. So you formed the belief that it rained in Virginia yesterday. And we would say that that belief is justified. Right? Nobody would accuse you of flouting any duty if you formed a belief that it rained in Virginia yesterday. What does this show? It seems, that true, justified belief itself is not enough. And the reason is justification is something that is internal to us. But it's no guarantee that the reason you believe something, the logos you provide, is connected to the truth itself. We may be justified in believing things that are true, and yet our justification has no connection to its being, that proposition's being true. Now, this shows that there seems to be something problem up there. It seems like you either need something else or you need to re-tailor the notion of justification. And this is to introduce another issue in epistemology, and that is the issue between what is called internalism versus externalism. Internalism teaches that justification is something that is provided by you being able to give an account for why you hold something to be true, and that account is generally, by whatever criterion you're using, reasonable. Okay, that nobody would convict you of some type of flouting of a duty. Externalists say that there's something more. In fact, they don't like to use the word justification. They like to use the word warrant. They talk about what's called warrant. Now, what's interesting about this position is that the externalists, sometimes they're called reliabilists, but reliabilism is really a version of externalism. But the externalists or the reliabilists say that what matters is not that you have a reason for your belief that you can articulate, but your belief is somehow connected to some reliable way in which you form beliefs, some reliable belief-producing mechanism. Now, what's interesting about this is that externalism is that it accounts for, it seems, the belief that many Christians have in God. Because if you ask many Christians why they believe in God, not in this realm, but other Christians, why you believe in God, they may do what? Fail to provide any answer. Why do I believe in God? Oh, well, I don't know. You know, it seems reasonable, or they may not be able to give any reason. Would we say that they don't know that God exists if they're not able to give a justification, give a reason? Would you say that? They know, we would say, God exists, because all men know God exists, and by implication, so do they. So what are we going to say in that case? How do they know that God exists if they can't provide a reason? They know because they believe in God's existence, and they have warrant to believe it because it is what? Given to them by God, right? They have a sense of deity, as Calvin called it, and so they sense God's existence. They have natural revelation, and they have a faculty to understand it, though they pervert it. It gets through to them. And the Christian who is redeemed, we're talking about a Christian in this case, has redeemed senses, so to speak, and he has the Word of God. They are perfectly within their rights to believe in God and claim to have knowledge, even though they're not able to provide justification. So I think this tripartite version of knowledge has a good deal of truth in it, but it doesn't capture the whole picture, does it? Right? Christians and all of us, Christians or non-Christians, know many things that they're not able to give an account of. So you can know things, it seems, without being able to provide justification. Just so long as what? There is warrant that the belief is produced by some reliable belief-producing mechanism. Whether it is our receiving of God's revelation, our hearing God's voice and following it, or something else. You can have knowledge without being able to provide justification for it. Now, that doesn't mean that there's something inherently good about this position, right, or superior. I mean, it's always good to be able to provide justification for your beliefs. But as Christians, we're going to reject that those that you cannot have knowledge without providing a justification. The young Christian who doesn't know anything about apologetics knows his God, even though he has no way defending that in any type of argumentation. He has warrant because it's produced by a faculty that God has given him. Well, I wouldn't call it a faculty. I'd call it Calvin called it a sense, and it makes it sound like a faculty, but I don't think that's what Calvin means. The seed of religion, this natural disposition that God gives us when we come into contact with His world to spontaneously generate a belief in His goodness, His existence, His benevolence, His sovereignty, etc. Okay, so knowledge. What is knowledge? True, justified belief, but as long as we understand that justification has some problems right here. Okay, now getting back to the main story, justification. What constitutes justification is going to depend upon one's worldview, doesn't it? One's worldview. Now, the Christian worldview is going to have its specific answers to what constitutes justification. What ultimately is going to justify our claims to knowledge? Okay, corresponds with the Word of God. It is either revealed in God's Word, or is offer a good necessary consequence from God's Word, or we know on the basis of our experience of the world that is grounded upon God's revelation to us. So yeah, it's going to be ultimately, justification is ultimately going to come through revelation. So God's revelation is going to provide ultimately our justification. So our view of knowledge and the non-Christian's view of knowledge may formally, on the page of paper, look like it's the same thing. Right? But our understanding of belief and understanding of truth is going to be different, and our understanding of justification is going to be vastly different. This is because our epistemologies are going to be antithetical to each other. So here's an example where we can agree on paper, just like we agree with the papists on the Trinity. We agree with their doctrine of the Trinity formally, but when you start unpacking it, you don't really agree with it, do you? Right? Their doctrine of the Trinity is erroneous because it leads to their faulty doctrine of soteriology. Probably the other way around, but however you want to explain it, they really don't believe in the same triune God as we do. Same way with the unbeliever and the believer when it comes to knowledge. They have a different theory of knowledge, even if on paper it sounds the same. So, what is the relationship between apologetics and epistemology? Well, epistemology is a study of knowledge, and it's the way in which we justify our knowledge claims. We've got to understand what knowledge is in a Christian way. And that is going to determine for us how we're going to approach the defense of the faith. Knowing this, knowing that true justified belief is what God says it is going to have a great impact on how we go about defending the Christian religion. And so how is it going to impact it? It's going to be impacted by what types of things we're going to accept and what we're going to press on other people. We're going to show that their account of knowledge is ultimately deficient. Their view of truth is going to be deficient because they don't have the truth. They're going to define truth in one of the ways that I mentioned earlier: correspondence, coherentist, pragmatist, and maybe other ways, right? There's a semantic theory of truth, a performative theory of truth, and a newer one, too, that we don't need to talk about. There's different theories of truth. What we'll be able to do with the non-believer is to say, you don't know what knowledge is because you don't even know what truth is. Because what they do is they take one aspect of it that has some basis in truth in it, and they make an idol of it. So we'll show that the correspondence theory, for example, is not a good theory of truth. Not because there's nothing right about it, but because it neglects the other aspects of truth, and because it doesn't do any philosophical work. To say that a proposition corresponds to a state of affairs doesn't cash out in anything beyond a metaphor. And similar things can be said about other theories of truth. The same thing we could say about belief, although we didn't go into that in much detail, and ultimately in justification. The non-Christian epistemologies are going to give their version of justification, but what we're going to do is show them that their view of justification is based upon their epistemologies are deficient because their epistemologies are themselves incoherent. And therefore, the only people that can dupe epistemology is the Christian church, the Christian people, because we're the only ones that have a coherent theory of knowledge. And now this is going to be a justification for the Christian religion. We have the only true theory of knowledge that there is. Now, let's move on to the seventh point. We'll talk about self-deception. And this will take us through the rest of this session and next session. And it's one of the most important aspects of apologetics as developed, the presuppositional apologetics as developed by Dr. Bahnsen. Most of you know that he did this PhD dissertation on this issue. And before we go into the issue itself, we have to ask why it is important. Why is the notion of self-deception so important to the Vantillian, to the presuppositional apologist? Why is the notion of we deceiving ourselves, man deceiving ourselves, a critical issue? The answer to that is because it's implied by the presuppositional method. The presuppositional method says that the Christian worldview and the non-Christian worldview are antithetical, that the Christian worldview provides the preconditions of knowledge, the non-Christian worldview does not, provides no conditions for knowledge. Therefore, in principle, anybody that holds to a non-Christian position cannot know anything. So that means that what? The non-believers who know things must do what? Must really be thinking like Christians. Now, here's the rub, though. When you ask them if they're thinking like Christians, if they believe in Scripture, if they believe the God of the Bible, they're going to say, of course, no. Of course we don't. Now the question there is, now we could answer very easily and say, well, they're just lying. They do and they're lying. And there's some truth to that, right? They're lying, but it's much more complicated than that. It's not a simple lie. It's a much more complicated lie. Because in Romans chapter 1, Paul tells us that the unbeliever does what with the truth that he knows? Suppresses it, right? He drives it down. He pushes it down. It's trying to get through, so it has to take some effort to get it down. Okay, he suppresses it. He says he doesn't know God. He suppresses that truth. And so in one sense, he knows it, right? But in another sense, he's gotten himself to not know it, to not believe it. Okay, and it's not just a simple matter of him lying. Do you believe in God? And the atheist can say, in some sense, no, and not be lying to you. Now, if this is the case, how can it be that he is in that position? How can somebody be in a position of knowing something and not knowing something, believing something and not believing something? Well, before we go into the details of this issue, it's important to realize that this is a common experience that human beings have. Human beings often deceive themselves. Okay, now, this isn't going to be a philosophical discussion. This doesn't justify it, but it's a common practice that we deceive ourselves. Now, we are all apt to it. Hopefully, as Christians, we suppress the drive to deceive ourselves, but even as Christians can do it. And let's take some silly example. Let's say that my goal in life is to be an NBA center. Okay? And if you knew me, every day after work for 4 hours, I'm on the basketball court, right? And I'm practicing as a 39-year-old, 6-foot white male. I'm going to be the first center that breaks the age barrier, the color barrier, and the size barrier. Okay, so I have this. Now, so I am practicing every day, and if you ask me, are you going to be a center in the NBA? I say, yes, I am. Yes, I am. And everything that you watch me, you say, well, he has the drive and things like that. And so you're going to say that he really believes, in some sense, he's going to be an NBA center, right? But you also know that I know better than that, right? That I know better. I really don't expect the phone to ring because I don't sit up at night waiting for the phone calls. I don't look at the post office. I don't look at my box of mail every morning looking for a letter from the Lakers or the Knicks or the whatever basketball team's out there. Okay, I really am not behaving as I could believe it, but I say it. Okay, that's an example of self-deception, a silly one. Here's one from more real life. And I have a relative who's very much like this. Bonson uses this example in his dissertation, but I know people like this. I have family members like this. She has some children. I shouldn't say be too specific because this is being recorded. That's what I don't like about being recorded. You can't talk about family very well on it. Destroy the evidence. But I have a relative who has 3 children who are hooligans. They have spent all of them time in penitentiaries. And we're not talking about municipal penitentiary or state. We're talking about federal penitentiaries. 2 of them, which I believe are in the can right now. One of them, I think, was convicted under the 3 strikes and you're in type of things. These are some bad boys. And they're the good side of the family. No, that's not true. You should see my other relatives. But I'm changing. Is my furlough pass still good for them? Okay. So this is who they are. But when you talk to this person, my relative, about them, she has nothing but good things to say about them. Nothing but good things to say. And they've been treated, you don't want to get too directly into their present status, but when you do, it was always what? Being unfair. The judge was being unfair. They're being misunderstood. They didn't really do it, or it wasn't really that bad. You know, these boys are good kids. They're good boys. Right? And she believes it. She will swear to it. She will say that they are her good boys that don't mean any harm and really don't deserve what they've got. She believes that. And she's not lying to us. And yet, I know for a fact, because my dad told me this, that when one of the boys was over at a house spending the night, she hid her credit cards from him. Huh? Now, why would you do that? Why would you hide your credit cards from your good children, who wouldn't do anything wrong, who are misunderstood and get an unfair shake in the world? Well, what is going on in her? She is deceiving herself, isn't it? She's deceiving herself. She knows better, but it's too painful for her to admit. And that's what's important here psychologically. To admit that about her children, that they're hooligans, is to admit that she is probably, this is what's probably most painful, is that she was a failure as a mother. Right? Because if you have 0 out of 3, I mean, you got to question your child-rearing skills, right? I mean, I think even in the most absurd evangelical churches, if you have 3 children that are all in the pen, even they might wonder, are you fit to be in that office? So she can't get herself to admit it. And besides, it's very painful to admit that your children are bad, aside from your own feelings, right? Aside from your own maternal or paternal feelings, it'd be hard to admit your children are no good. And so completely understandable. Her motivation is completely understandable. She can't get herself to admit. It's too painful to admit that her children are no good. We have examples of this in all of our lives. We have deceived ourselves at times. If you read literature, you'll see it over and over again. It's one of the predominant themes in our literature, self-deception. Okay, now, that it is common is a given. That we have experienced ourselves seems to me to be obvious. But the question is, how is self-deception really possible? Is self-deception really possible? And some philosophers have argued that it is not possible. Okay, there is really no such thing as self-deception. Why not? Why would they say this? And by the way, if there is no such thing as self-deception, then that throws presuppositional apologetics into some doubt, doesn't it? Because we have to be able to provide, it teaches that there is self-deception, but if some philosopher shows that there can't be, then something's gone wrong. So what is their argument against the deceiving of yourself? Well, first of all, we understand what deception is and how it usually works. Right? Deception usually works by somebody being in the know, right? Somebody knowing the truth, and yet deceiving another person with a lie, right? You deceive them by a lie. Now, there's other ways to deceive people, but the easiest way or the most typical way is to lie to them. Now, we can deceive others very easily because the other one is not in the know as we are. If I have privileged information that somebody else has and I tell them something that I know to be not true, then it's very easy to understand how they can be deceived. Right? Because the one who's being deceived and the deceiver are two distinct centers of consciousness. They have different belief systems, different experiences, different sets of knowledge. That makes sense. Deception conceptually makes sense. But the argument now is, but it makes no sense to be a self-deceiver. Because in the case of the self-deceiver, you are in a privileged position as the deceiver to know what the truth is. But because the deceiver is the same person as the deceivee, to make up a term, then there's no way to get it to work. Right? If you know that you're lying to yourself, why would you believe yourself? Right? It doesn't make any sense, according to this argument. Moreover, it's contradictory, because it entails that P, which is, well, say S, the subject believes P, and also S believes not P. And that is called what? Pardon me? Well, something like a contradiction, isn't it? You believe a contradiction. Now, these aren't contradictory. Right, so be careful. So one of the criticisms is not that these are contradictory. They're not. What's the contradiction of this? S believes P. What's the contradiction? Anybody No? Well, okay, that's fine. You say it in a different way. Right. It's not the case that S believes P. Right? S does not believe P. Right. So that's the contradiction of this. This is S believes not P. Now, the person, S remembers the same person. S believes contradictory things, but these two propositions are not contradictory. Now, this seems to be problematic because it violates one of the rules of philosophical psychology, which is a reasonable rule, and that is the rule of charity. People typically don't believe contradictory things. In fact, some would argue that's an impossibility to believe contradictory things knowingly. Okay? Certainly, we can believe contradictory things unwittingly. Right? I might believe something, have some theory over here that implies A, and I might believe a different theory, right? That on the surface is complementary to this other theory, but it implies, if you do some deductions, not A. So it may be by implication I believe contradictory things. Most philosophers say that's possible. But self-consciously, right, knowingly believing P and not P, that's not possible. And there's some good reason to believe this, right? Get yourself to believe P and not P. You're going to have to convert to Zen Buddhism or something like that. Right? Try to get yourself to believe something to be the case and that same thing not to be the case. A proposition and its negation. Try to get yourself to believe that. Right? No matter how much you would want to believe one or the other or the falsity of one, it doesn't seem very likely or very possible that you can get yourself to believe both things. Okay, now, the argument against self-deception isn't one that you should consider a conclusive knockdown argument. But it seems to be, to me, pretty powerful. The two considerations against self-deception are that the deceiver and the deceivee are the same, and so how can you deceive yourself into believing something you know to be the case or not to be the case? How can you get yourself in that position when you have privileged access to the information you are trying to deceive yourself on? And then secondly, it implies that the believer believes contradictory things, which seems very implausible psychologically. Okay, so these are very strong arguments. So how do we get away from this? How many of you have read the Bahnsen dissertation? Somebody told me that they're reading the Bahnsen dissertation today. Who did it? Was it you? Okay, so we have somebody who is a ringer here. So what's the answer to this according to Bahnsen? Pardon me? He's going to say what about this? Well, Bahnsen is pretty much going to give this to him. He's going to say, okay, this doesn't seem very plausible. Okay, S believes P and S believes not P. That doesn't seem plausible. Right? I think even Greg would say something stronger than that. But put it in my sense, no, I don't think it's contradictory, but it's not very plausible. And he at least agrees that far. So he's given up, right? He's given up and said there is no such thing as self-deception. Well, he says that though this criticism as it stands like this is a good one, this is not the right way to model what's going on in self-deception. What's really going on in self-deception is something quite different than this. Okay, what you have, according to Bahnsen, is that you have two different types of belief. Two different types, but they're not on the same level. They're on different levels. Now, before I give you his answer or his solution here, let me explain different levels or orders of the belief, as they're often called. How many of you believe that, I'm going to make something up absurd, that as soon as you hear it, you'll believe it, but you'll never thought of it before? How many of you believe that Alpha Centauri is farther from the sun than Venus? Raise your hand. Okay. Some of you are asleep then if you don't believe that. Maybe you don't know what Alpha Centauri is. It's the closest star to us other than the sun. Okay, so we all believe that, right? We all believe that. How many of you believe that you believe that? Now, all of you have believed that. Even before I said it, you believed it. But how many of you had a belief that you believed that? You did? Bless me. So you thought of it before and you thought, I not only have this belief, I believe I have this belief. I not only have the belief, but I've thought about it. Oh. So there's always one that ruins the example. Okay. But most of us normal people haven't thought about that, right? Most of us haven't thought about that. And there's many beliefs that are like this. We have lots of beliefs, right? You go into the restaurant, you see the menu that's red. And if you form the belief, maybe a tacit belief, you form the belief that what? The menu is red. But that's as far as it goes, right? You never think about that belief unless somebody says, oh, we went to Roosters. Do you remember what color their menus were? Then you might scratch your head and say, yeah, I believe they were red. And so at that point, what have you done? You have a belief that it's red, and now you what? You think about the belief, it becomes a second-order belief. I believe that I believe the menu is red. It makes perfect sense, right? We have lots of beliefs, but we can formulate beliefs about our beliefs. Now, if there's second-order beliefs, there's no reason to stop there, right? We can have third-order beliefs. I can believe that I believe that I believe that the menu is red. Although when it gets to third order and beyond, we get confused very quickly, right? But there's certainly, it's easy to make a distinction between a first order belief and a second order belief. I believe that there is an eraser on the podium. But if I wanted to think about it a moment, I could formulate, yes, I believe that I believe that, right? Do I believe that I believe it? Yes, I do. I thought about it. And then if I think about it even further, I can believe that I believe that I believe that there's an eraser on this podium. All this is to show that there are different orders of beliefs that we have. Now, Bahnsen is going to take this well-known to philosophers' insight and use it to solve, or realign, I should say, reconfigure this whole analysis. This analysis, he says, is wrong. This is okay here. S believes that P. And this is a first-order belief. And that is what? S believes that Johnny is no good. Right? S believes that he is not going to be an NBA player. Okay? S believes something. Right? But then what happens? He formulates in self-deception a second-order belief. He formulates a belief about his belief. He can get himself to believe, S believes, that S believes not P. Here you see the belief is the proposition. Right, whatever it is. In this case, one of the examples is Johnny is no good. Here, we have S believing something about what? S's own belief. Right? S believes that S believes, and this is, once you have an iteration of beliefs, you have different orders, right? This is a first order belief here, this is a first order belief here. So once you embed a belief that statement into another believes that statement, the second one becomes a second order belief statement. So what's happening here? Is somebody who's deceiving themselves believing a contradiction? S believes P, S believes not P. No. You have no contradiction here. Right? Do you see any contradiction? Well, you cannot possibly be in contradiction with yourself here because what? As it stands here, maybe by implication, but as it stands, because first order beliefs cannot ever contradict second order beliefs. And so you have no contradiction there, but what you have is an explanation. S believes P, but S has got himself to believe something about himself, namely that he doesn't believe it. Now that shows that there is no psychological contradiction. There is no logical contradiction, but there's no psychological contradiction in self-deception. And this, I think, is a very nice analysis of what's going on. Very nice analysis that Bahnsen gives us. He shows us that self-deception is possible. He shows us that it really is a deception, right? You, because you believe something false about yourself. But that is not psychologically contradictory to do so. Now, psychologically problematic, and it is ethically and logically problematic as well, but it is psychologically possible to get yourself into this state. And it seems to capture what happens in self-deception. Now, we'll break for a few minutes, but when we come back, there's something else that we need to say something of, a few more remarks about this, and then we'll conclude on our discussion of self-deception. And we may have enough time to start section number 8. We'll see how it goes.